Okay, so today is a kind of spontaneous event where we have some contributions. We might have someone defending the Hardle Walking proposal today as well. Following up yesterday's, so let's just get started with Scott.
Okay, so I promise to keep this brief. So I'm going to start by saying there's a number of people. First off, I guess we have a different diverse audience here, but there's a number of people in the audience that maybe want to say, if people find this interesting, want to hear more about this in the future. So like Filippo is here and Paolo's work I'll mention in a minute. So I'm just going to be really brief. I think the idea was to throw out some ideas quickly, and if people want to discuss, we have discussion. Otherwise, we move on to the next topic. So I wanted to say something about dark energy models, sort of motivated by last week's discussion by Dragan. So he put up some graphs similar to this. You have the W versus WA plane, and the idea is that,
W equals minus one
is a really good fit, but people that are in the dark energy community are interested in establishing what you might call realistic models of dark energy. So one of the motivations behind what I'm about to say is a way of sort of generate some sort of theoretical way to generate models that might be taken as serious alternatives to the cosmological constant. Before I get too serious, I just want to say, of course, there's absolutely nothing wrong with lambda CDM, as we were reminded by Planck. But the basic idea here is that even if you don't, if you just are convinced that it's a cosmological constant, it would be nice to have some, at least for these people that study dark energy models, a systematic way to collect all the other possibilities compared to lambda CDM. So our approach on doing this, and actually some earlier work before us, was to, we know in particle physics, effective field theories are very good at doing this. That's how we made all the progress with the standard model. More recently, this has been applied to inflation. And so it was sort of an academic exercise to try to go apply the same type of reasoning to dark energy model building. So to very quickly remind you of these two approaches, because I think most of the people, well, half the audience has already worked on this. The other half, I'm probably not going to be able to explain it in one slide, but I'll give it a shot. So it's basically two approaches. The first approach, which is taken by Weinberg, is to simply take the theory of inflation at the level of the background, consider the first set of higher derivative corrections that would come in. This is done in a perturbative way. And then you ask, can we probe these higher derivative corrections to the background? And so that was done by Weinberg. You just expand the fields in some simple derivative expansion like the impleton and the metric. Approach two, which is a little more sophisticated, is instead of expanding the background, you're actually doing an expansion in the perturbations themselves. So that was done by some people in this room. And the one of the utilities of this is you realize that this background, the cosmological background, has a time dependence, so it spontaneously breaks time diffeomorphisms. And so you write down the most general theory of perturbations that preserve the spatial diffs that are left behind. So this is this second approach has several advantages. First of all, the authors were smart enough to notice that the inflationary background is not directly observable. So that motivates just focusing on the perturbations. When we talk about observations from inflation, we're really talking about the perturbations. Because you know that this, when you go to high energy, that you restore this broken time diffeomorphism, you get basically asymptotically de Sitter space. You need to make sure that your low energy effective theory nonlinearly realizes that, much like in the case of the Higgs. And that builds special relationships between parameters, for example, the speed of sound and the level of non-Gaussianity, and I think everybody knows that. And another advantage of this approach is it can capture what you might call nonlinear backgrounds, backgrounds where you can't just simply expand in a derivative expansion, but something like EVA's DBI model, where all of those derivatives at the level of the background can be equally important. And so this approach captures all of this. The only disadvantage really is that the background is taken to be inflationary a priori. And perhaps in this case, that's not really a disadvantage. But we'll see in what I'm about to summarize that maybe it is.
I guess I wouldn't call it a disadvantage. Just this is an approach which captures certain things and doesn't capture other.
That sounds better, yes. But, so just to advertise at the beginning, the first, at least to my knowledge, the first time this was tried to apply to dark energy model building was with Paolo and Filippo. where they applied this effective field theory reasoning to quintessence, and they got some nice results. I forgot to put the other reference here. But they got nice results in the sense that a lot of people had proposed models where W is less than minus 1. There are always these issues about stability. And they showed that you can take things like the W plus 1 plane versus the speed of sound, and you can put constraints on this models of quintessence from an effective field theory point of view. So for example, you can show that some low sound speed models can have W less than minus 1 by introducing these higher derivative corrections to stabilize it. So that's sort of a quick advertisement. So that was the first real application of this to the dark energy sector. So what we did a couple years ago is we just naively set out to take Weinberg's paper, because that was the simplest possible framework, and just take that and extend it to dark energy. So it's really just academic. You take the fields involved, you take the scalar field, the dark energy field, you expand it in some derivative expansion and calculate all the leading corrections that depend on the field, that depend on the presence of matter, and that depend on higher derivative corrections on the gravity side. Again, this is all done perturbatively. So even in this simple example that you can do, there are some subtleties that come up that aren't necessarily present in the case of inflation. Two of these are this hierarchy of scales that appear. So of course, we don't just have the scale of quantum gravity and the scale of inflation, but we also have other fields, mainly, for example, dark matter that's around. And so that should be important. And in fact, a lot of the observations we're interested in are observations that influence or affect dark matter. And so the presence of these additional fields lead to a hierarchy of scales, the dark energy scale, what you might call the standard model scale, quantum gravity scale, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. All the standard model particles as they freeze out in the history of the universe. So it's a lot more complicated. And this matter sector is also present. So the number of terms that could have been that were reduced in the case of Weinberg cannot be thrown away in the case of this dark energy, where you have this additional matter sector present. And so I've just written down a couple examples of the types of operators that are the leading corrections. One example is the stress energy tensor of the dark matter would come with a cutoff that depends on the matter sector, whereas the dark energy field would have a completely different scale. And even inside of these coefficients, which are arbitrary functions of the field, you can also have additional scales. So it's a little bit messy. But the mess gets larger because you also want to capture modified gravity. That's a proposal for cosmic acceleration. So here, you can play a little bit of a trick. We know from earlier work that in the case of DGP, there's this regime of scales, which are certainly interesting observationally, where you can think of a modification of gravity as some Goldstone boson that gave, for example, a mass to the graviton. It can be the brain bending mode in DGP. If instead you're interested in F of R gravity, it can just be the fact that that's just a scalar tensor theory. And so what's, I think, pretty well known is that there's a regime, especially important for linear probes on large-scale structure, where modification of gravity really, again, means just scalar tensor theory. So you're back to the same Lagrangian we started with. You just have a non-minimal coupling to gravity. And then again, you can consider sort of the k-essence type, not k-essence, that's a misprint, effective field theory of quintessence that Paolo and collaborators looked at earlier. So the idea is you have this framework, you want to calculate the most general thing. Okay, so how would you actually use this in practice? The idea is once you have this theory and you've identified the leading corrections, you want to consider perturbations about this, because again, that is more or less what we observe. So in particular, the Newtonian potential is sensitive to the growth of structure, whereas gravitational lensing is sensitive to both of the potentials and the metric perturbations. And so this gives you a way to distinguish between modified gravity models and just simple, for example, quintessence models, because anytime you modify gravity, this parameter we introduced into the action in our effective theory, that will give us a difference between these two potentials, whereas if it's not a modification of gravity, this term would not be there in the absence of anisotropic stress. And so these two terms would be equal, and that gives you a way to distinguish these models. Furthermore, you can look at the modified equation for growth. This leads to some G effective. So there's some effective Newton constant, which again depends on the parameters of the effective field theory. So the point is that given this parameterization, you can go out and try to match this stuff to observations at some level. So at the end of the day, what you really get is basically three types of correction terms out of all the possible things you could write down. You get some Gauss-Binet-like term, some coupling to the Einstein tensor, and then this, again, this k-essence type type leading term. And then if you want to say, on a theoretical level, you want to at least have the weak equivalence principle, then that means you have some arbitrary function in the Einstein frame multiplying matter uniformly. And then an additional kinetic correction here. So that might look a little messy, but that's it. That's all you can have. Anything else that you write down is related to this by the equations of motion or integration by parts. So just to show that you can use this for something, taking these terms, with Rachel Bean, we took these coefficients. Again, setting the coefficients in a natural way is already, for me, a difficult question. It's much different than the case of inflation, but taking these to take some values, you can show that just requiring that you started at high z with some matter-dominated universe, and that you allow the system to evolve. It's well known that a lot of systems don't show this attractor-type behavior, where you take these corrections, you add them into your theory, you go to high energy, or in this case, into dark matter, you let the system evolve. This black line represents lambda CDM. Please don't ask me what W effective is, unless you want to know. So this is lambda CDM, and then you can see in the case of the Gauss-Binet corrections, you can actually get some sort of constraints on what the values of this can be, because you see this does not fall into the attractor flow towards a universe that's accelerating in lambda CDM, which we know is a really good fit to the data. The other terms I talked about, they're basically fine with lambda CDM. So there's a proof of principle. You can at least have one type of parameter in this model constrained, but most of it would look like lambda CDM. So it is possible to have some sort of constraint, in this case in the form of an attractor, checking for the attractor behavior. But on top of the fact that these corrections, basically they're small, we knew they were going to be small and they're small. In addition to that, any nonlinearity of the background, which, for example, in the case of modified gravity is the whole point, that's missed by this approach. So I'm almost done. But moving on to approach number two, and this is what a lot of people in the room have worked on, is now let's, like in the case of inflation, let's assume the background is lambda CDM, and let's just construct the theory of perturbations about that time-broken background. So already, you can see this is getting a little bit messier than the case in inflation, mainly because you have this additional matter sector and you have this non-minimal coupling to gravity, but it has the advantage that, again, you can make contact with what is called realistic models of modifications of gravity. So almost done. So the basic idea is just at the quadratic level, when you reintroduce this Goldstone field, you get something that looks like this. You can again have relationships between the various parameters. You have coupling to gravity, but it's really quite messy. It's not clear to me that how useful this would be for observations, but this is something you get out. And in particular, by taking certain limits of this Lagrangian, as been shown in all three of these papers, you can reproduce the various models that people have considered in the literature. And they all drop out as examples. You can also use this to discover new models that people haven't thought about, which was one of the goals, was to put more points on the W not equal to minus one plane. So in conclusion, I just wanted to state some questions. My main reason I was wanting to talk about this in the first place is this really something that's worth exploring further? When I talk to people that work on dark energy experiments, they think this is great because it gives some guidance to what models you should consider and not. I'm more pessimistic, maybe more pessimistic than my colleagues in the room. So there is this problem of hierarchy of scales. When I already look at Matthias's work, which I think we're going to hear about tomorrow, there's interesting issues that pop up there just at the level of dark matter. And here we're throwing in dark energy. There's some sense, which I was talking to Dan about, that there's this non-locality because we know that we go from matter domination to dark energy domination. There's this switchover that seems to require, you don't have this single clock that's going through. The equations are complicated. Maybe that could be just addressed by numerics. It's difficult to measure the coefficients, et cetera, et cetera. So in the end, you sort of just want to maybe say that W is equal to minus one, and you shouldn't modify gravity to understand it. Okay, but so these are some of the questions I was hoping we could discuss if people are interested.
Lets you discover new models. I mean, that is actually hard to do in this room, isn't it? Because you write down some theory of the perturbations that you don't know where it came from. And one thing you might wonder is, if it is used for beautiful, especially in situations where we think it might come to bottom line, we are.
Yes, I agree.
Even in inflation, or you know, you might want to impose something like that black hole thermodynamics works out in the normal way. And just as a theoretical, maybe it's too much of a prejudice, but it's possibly a consistency condition. And that's just an example.
Mm-hmm. So, no, I agree.
I guess there's no way around that.
Well, yeah.
I mean, just writing down these theories of the perturbations doesn't guarantee that it's
Yes, I agree. I agree completely. So already with this attractor example I gave, I thought that was sort of a very basic way of showing, I mean, from a cosmological perspective, if it doesn't make sense in the matter and radiation phases, then it's not going to make sense as a dark energy proposed model. But yeah, all I meant by discovering model.
You could go the other way, I guess you could say, these are the possible
Well, could you do something intermediate? I mean, you can, of course, you can just go to models. If you want UV completion, you better make a model, right? But could you, for example, is it an interesting constraint to require that the perturbations satisfy the null energy condition, for example? So that would rule out some of those things.
Right.
Right. So, I mean, You could try to make a statement that, you know, trying to see if there's a statement like requiring the null energy condition doesn't allow you to go to some region of parameters or doesn't allow you to populate some observables.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be an interesting statement.
So what is the status of with modifying the null energy condition? Can we get any data on these people's giving up the world? Null energy condition violators. And so is this about, how seriously should I take the fact that I should be
I think.
So we have the violators and the enforcers.
So, okay, yeah, what is the.
I mean, I don't know. I mean, I stopped working on, I did some work on DGP and the ghost condensate, but I mean, the ghost condensate, for example, I would say you can violate the null energy condition without perturbative instabilities, and
right.
We just don't know whether the theory holds.
Exactly. So that's my question. I, there are many examples of the null energy effective theory like this. You're fine. You check everything, and some people don't even check. But let's take.
they check,
and there's these examples. You start the universe, like this.
I don't care. I'm just saying phenomenologically. This debate is that it would be, you know, it would be interesting if there was a phenomenological way to decide. Right.
Well, is there, so there's no instability.
There's no instability.
But is there, again, if you consider there may be instability.
So even black hole thermodynamics uh-huh. might actually work because there's some time scale issue. You screw up black hole thermodynamics, but on long enough time scales, then the black holes just evaporate away.
But
you have to push things. You always have to push. There's assumptions about the UV completion that you have to push to the maximum and so on.
But as I understand correctly, you're saying it evaporates, so you never, so you just have to regard the Hawking calculation and the way it fits into the
you violate, let's see, what is it exactly? This is not something I directly worked on, so this is just memory. So there's some papers by Shinji Mukuyama, which I think are the last word on this. So that I know of anyway. And I think somehow the point is there that you try to violate the second law, but it takes you a long time to do it. And by that time, the black hole is gone. It's in that sort of direction. So in principle, you can screw up thermodynamics, but your system is also unstable, right? A black hole is actually an unstable object.
We're going away from the null energy to that as especially in the ABS, CFT, or how the thermodynamic interpretations or stable black holes.
That would not be relevant in the real world,
though.
Yeah.
Well, I'd be very worried about theories that violate the null energy condition. haven't worked on them myself, so I can't directly. But I mean, things like, is there a positive energy theorem in these theories? Can you prove that the total energy is in no way distributed? Is your color asymptotic and flat? I mean, the usual proofs require a dominant energy condition, which is stronger than the other. So they don't have, so they don't worry that you would have situations where you could just radiate arbitrarily large amounts of energy. The energy is not required to stay positive, so it goes negative and it keeps radiating.
In fact, the only stability you have is there's a quantity, which is a conserved charge, which is positive definite only at linearized order. So you don't have any, that's right, so you don't have any, that's right.
I know DGP is unstable, right? There's papers showing instabilities. So to me, that means the theory is not viable.
Yeah, I guess one of the points I was trying to make is that, I mean, already at the level of observations, it wasn't viable. I mean, I guess there's theory versus experiment, but you can rule out a large amount of these models just by looking at the way structure evolves.
But it would be perceived to be false reasonable theoretical.
Yeah, one that's already in here is the weak equivalence principle, but that's...
Yeah. I can just say my personal opinion is that violating gravity, or sorry, violating gravity, I'm giving my opinion before I even get to the verb, that modifying gravity is a desperate act. I mean, it's a horror, you know, it's not something, when you're doing it, yes, you are giving up tons and tons of stuff. So in my mind, the only interesting question is that, okay, but can you rule it out? You know, or can you, so to me, that if you're going to, since it didn't, I mean, when we first started doing it, the dream was it was going to solve some problem. Yes, you were giving up all this stuff, maybe, or we didn't actually even know at the beginning what we were giving up either. So we, you know, and we wanted to see what we're giving up. Maybe we can solve some problem. Turns out you don't gain anything, okay, except a weird phenomenology, and I don't think that's changed.
I mean, the hope
very
was to
subtle.
Solve the CC problem.
Right.
Some problem.
Never came anywhere near that. Nothing. No sign. Not even a whiff. Nothing. Okay. But the only thing that I think is potentially interesting is that it's like the stuff that Clifford Will has been doing forever. You can like use modified theories. You can do some phenomenology. You know.
I mean, it's really good to understand why gravity is very constrained, if that's the case. I mean, it's very worthwhile to explore what the consistency conditions
sure.
really are.
No, it'd be great to prove some theorem that you know, that it might, it's incompatible with unitarity or something.
Right.
That would be great.
And this applies to things with just additional scale of fields, or
yeah.
But do you know the answer? If you do just impose the null energy condition, do you know, does that restrict the phenomenology in an interesting way, or is it?
I haven't myself looked at that, but maybe these guys have.
You just impose it naturally.
Of the fluctuations. So the fluctuations, and this is well defined, no? I mean, the background.
You mean the, okay.
It's just right here, right? I guess.
So that you say that if I now jiggle this field just artificially with this Lagrangian on my background,
I can't violate
the null energy condition. I'm not saying the solution violates it. I'm saying I cannot, if I had some source that coupled to these fluctuations, which maybe I don't, mm-hmm. because that's the sort of model that would give you lots of problems, right? That would be a clear signal that probably you're talking about something very dangerous. Right, and so it would. And if you could say phenomenologically, look, this half of this plot, this is completely model independent with a few assumptions, but this is you would prove a theorem that says that this measure, if you measure experimentalists measure this, they found evidence for violation of the null energy condition.
Yeah,
no,
it's a new trend.
So do these surveys, which are looking for things like this, also have some astrophysical benefit?
I think always.
Astrophysical benefit.
Okay, we have this system. We have,
it's a full employment program for technologists.
It's a programmatic thing, clearly, to improve the calculations of what you need to capture these effects, but suppose, you know, you do all that, do you learn something about the real world for sure that... Maybe have this discussion.
The only things that you learn from the fact that you're... It's not there for a fundamental interest, any of those things you learn.
What do you mean fundamental?
Well, I mean, if somebody learns something about the weather and something that likes to be...
You know, we're learning about some weather, you know, or the pocket monkey bird or whatever, so always the same.
I mean, yeah, I mean, my, since we're sharing our opinions, in my personal opinion, the, using those surveys to do things like non-Gaussianity is, you know, in my humble opinion, better motivated than, you know, more gravity studies or modified gravity. But even there, it's a big project. I mean, there's a motivation from the fact that, you know, CFE hasn't done that well on certain shapes of non-Gaussianity, et cetera, et cetera. So just reiterating that, one should lump all of these things in the same category. But
though I agree, don't you forget about any model.
Yeah.
Phenomenologically, don't you want to make sure that W is minus one to at least a few percent there?
Yeah,
to make sure.
Yeah, also curvature. I mean,
and curvature.
Yeah.
And just more generally, too, I would just say that, you know, W minus one comes with its own radical theoretical baggage, right? Namely, if we really think that that's it, just a cosmological constant omega minus one, we're probably believing in some kind of anthropic, some kind of selection, some kind of not parameters being, you know, and so there is a lot at stake there.
If you saw
omega is minus 1.2 or something, you would be saying, I think that you would be delivering a pretty mighty blow to anthropics.
You would have an interesting puzzle in general.
Yeah. So I mean, what I'm saying, there are principles at stake that are big.
Right?
There aren't models that maybe are not models out there. There's somebody's beautiful model that, you know, a string theorist would love that predicts W equals minus 1.2. But
I think Nemanja has one.
He has many models. I can't keep track.
No, they have that.
You're keeping track. I'm just saying, I think there is a big principle at stake, right? So.
Oh, I totally agree.
It's not like checking Lorentzian variance, right? What are the chances that some precision test of Lorentzian variance is going to uncover a deviation in the next digit?
Yeah, you say minus one is a threshold number already. So.
It's not boring. Minus one is pretty amazing.
It's still like we will not spend so much money to test Lorentzian variance. But in a sense, it's always a question of how much expensive.
Right, because there's no reason to think, I mean, Lorentzian variance is poor. More of them, we've got a lot of Lorentzian variance, we'll have even more. But somehow the cosmological constant seems to be a different thing. Maybe, I don't know.
So what's Horndesky?
This general action that only gives two derivative equations of motion. This can be even high coefficient.
You can Yeah, so, okay, I missed the discussion yesterday.
But I was said that it makes no sense.
I see, okay, good. Right, but there are like two levels at which it can make no sense. There's, first of all, there's the issue whether there's a question, there's an interesting scientific question to do with measures. And then secondly, there's the question like how, if there is an interesting question, how you go about finding a theory that answers. So let's first discuss whether there's an interesting question. And then we can decide whether it's interesting to find a theory that answers. And so then I think, I did write a paper about it recently, a couple of weeks ago, in which I attempted to make clear there was an interesting question. And in my paper, what do I do there? I just draw a very simple kind of effective inflationary potential. We are down here right now, and we're going to ask this, in my opinion, scientifically justified question, what the pattern of CMB fluctuations is that we should observe. And let's imagine that we can roll down from that side while inflating, and or we could have rolled down from the other side while inflating. And it's a very clear question. If the pattern of CMB fluctuations differs depending on which side we roll down from, all right, what do we predict we should observe? This is a standard question in science. And so I think cosmology eventually will have to phase up to address this issue entirely. And you can see the problem. There's going to be a set of CLs here, and there's going to be another set of CLs there. And the effective inflationary contours, like a tilt and the density to scalar ratio, can differ from both sides. And so what you would need to answer this question is a kind of probability distribution, a kind of prediction, a kind of instructions for betting, so to speak, which kind of spectrum you should observe. And so that's clearly not given by just writing down this potential or the dynamical model. Indeed, this kind of potential doesn't say whether inflation occurred at all. It's much, much more challenging. So the situation is very similar to it is not unlike the situation in particle physics, I would say. Particle physics, Del HC, we collide particles, we create a Higgs, and we calculate quantum mechanical probabilities for different decay channels. Then we go about measuring these and so forth. Those quantum mechanical probabilities, the analog of those things, is what I would say are the probabilities for this kind of rolling down or that kind of rolling down.
But I think there's a huge difference, which you'll speak to. But in the LHC case, you have a complete S matrix. You can send in different states.
Yeah.
So you have exquisite control of the initial condition.
That's right.
You do not have a preferred state.
No. I don't think there is a preferred state.
You are assuming that in LHC you're colliding many particles. Here, who's telling you that a lot of universes are being created?
Right. So the difference.
We have no idea about.
Of course.
Anything else.
The similarity is as far as the quantum mechanical probabilities are concerned for different decay products of a much more general, much more abstract quantum mechanical state that combines all these rolling classical backgrounds. Of course, we don't have control over the state. That's what you're alluding to. That's quite clear. And that's what makes cosmology different. But the question is the same.
Wait, sorry. In the part of this case, there is a space of states that tells you what it is. And in cosmology.
Pick one. Right. Yeah.
Well,
right. Okay. So in the case of
just pick one, you consider many. That's what the LHC does. It considers the incoming state.
Yeah.
Basically.
No. I think it typically creates particles in the same state, and then calculates decay probabilities for decay channels. But you have control over your initial condition, control over the state. That's key. The difference between particle physics and cosmology is that you don't have control over the initial state in cosmology, and so it becomes part of the theory. You have to figure out what the state of the universe is.
And we also don't have even, you draw some possible, there might be many others, and we also...
Oh, there could be many other directions, right?
Yeah,
sure. Yeah, but okay. Man, this is theory, right? You have to have some theory if you want to make progress. These are going to be the ingredients.
You can propose a specific age, basically, and pose these questions already. You don't have to bring your hands about how there could be other ages.
Right. So this has been my.
If you want to come to some conclusion about it, you have to admit that there's a theoretical degeneracy there, which I think is one of the thesis.
Right. But it's already interesting. It's already very interesting and challenging compared with the LHC to assume you know the theory.
I don't claim to have the final theory, right? I'm just outlining what is an interesting question in cosmology. We are down here, and ultimately, just as in particle physics, we would like a theory that tells us what we should see. This is a bit like the pre-standard model phase, I think, in particle physics. We only have a vague idea of age, a vague idea of time, four models, and but we have to learn how to use these two ingredients to derive predictions. That's one goal, I think. And so how do you get predictions for observations? And secondly, of course, we have to understand how that kind of picture, if at all, fits into fundamental physics. Okay, so do we agree there's an interesting question? Kind of.
It's not clear whether there will be a solution. In a sense, it could be that there is no answer, that you need any input for the quantum states. It's not obvious that there is a solution, in a sense. It could be that you have to give me the initial state.
It could be that you have to modify quantum mechanics so drastically that nothing of this makes sense.
Before you jump into this.
This is not modifying quantum mechanics.
Yeah. No, I'm just saying.
There's going to be, if you don't modify quantum mechanics, there's bound to be some state.
If this is part of the theory of part of something that comes from outside, it's not open. So are you saying that this state will be derived?
No. No, I don't think it's unique. I don't think it needs to be unique. I think no one has an argument that it should be unique.
You see what we're... So this is like from yesterday, we were all busy talking about this. We're curious. It would seem that if we don't... So either we think we know what psi is, and then we can turn some cranks and get the kind of answers you want, or if we don't, that's a problem for getting the answers you want.
Well, no, but I think what Thomas could say is it's sort of like extending model building one step further. He has a model of both age and of the state. Let's see what it predicts.
That's all I'm saying.
That's all he's saying. If that's all you're saying, that's great.
That's all I'm saying.
Okay, it wasn't clear. So
yesterday you were.
But I wasn't there, so.
Yeah, but you'll be surprised what you said yesterday.
Don't worry, not disappointed you, but.
So to come back to that short paper that I wrote was precisely in this context. Pick an age and pick a state and check what comes out. That's very, very important. And why was I motivated? Precisely because of these constraints which begin to single out models that lie outside the planet contours or inside the likelihoods. So it is becoming interesting to take those combinations and look what kind of combinations psi and h are disfavored by observation. Okay, right? And okay, because I had an interesting contrast between the inner boundary wave function, the bottom line is that the inner boundary wave function favors these kind of universes, whereas there's other theories or other proposals of initial conditions that favor these kinds of universes, notably the tunneling wave function. So if you fix H, fix this simple potential, you can make a definite statement. And a statement which is not uninteresting in light of the...
But how are you going to break this degeneracy up? I mean, maybe there's never such a part of the...
So I don't
think... How are you going to make any progress?
Right, so just like in the standard model of particle physics, I think by measuring more and more resonances, it would have been very hard to find a standard model. Right, so I think toy model building in combination with observations is only going to go a certain way. But ultimately, you would want a compelling framework that, most importantly, makes further predictions. Right? If I say that psi, that the Hubble-Hawking state predicts these kind of universes, and furthermore, universes where this plateau is reasonably low, you make a further prediction that you should not see tensors. That's, I think, the only way forward, unless you have like a brilliant idea that fits it all.
So the thing, the problem, the sort of thing that's stuck in our craw in this field is that Alan Guth wrote this famous paper in 1981, inspiring us to think that we could explain the state, not choose it, but explain it, but dynamically select it. And that's, to this day, many of us remain inspired by that.
No, because I've already included Guth's idea.
No.
I've already selected inflation.
No, you haven't. His idea is that you have dynamics that explains the state, and you're putting it in.
His idea didn't work out, apparently, right?
Well, that's the question. So you seem content with that answer, and then we're kind of done with yesterday's conversation, and you're doing this thing, and that's fine, and we accept that.
But the thing
that gets people, excited. Or arguing is, should we be giving up this goal?
I think your view of initial conditions is too narrow here. I'm just asking an observational question. Where did we roll down?
I don't think I'm getting there. I think you're being narrow, but perfectly reasonably so.
I'm asking a dynamical question.
Yeah.
Which side did you roll down from?
Suppose, Thomas, just as a thought experiment, suppose we understood a complete theory of congruity, maybe string theory, well that we said what H was. We knew, Matthias said there's a lot of directions, but suppose we just could give you all the systematically the number counts of how many look like this or that. So that would at least fix H, and then you could conceivably get some strong peaking of your
probabilities.
From some combination of those number counts and your wave function, make some attempt to disentangle them, so that's far from that theoretically, but at least it is something theorists could work on getting H down.
It's clearly okay, the combinations are clearly gonna, the predictions are clearly gonna be a combination of the impact of psi and the impact of the structure of the landscape. That's clear. It's a huge disentangling process, but I don't think we have any alternative at this point. What I'd like to stress is that without going that way, without taking cosmology to that level, you have no start of asking this question. That's really all I'm saying. Be it dynamical or initial conditions, I think this is the wrong discussion. This is dynamical. I'm asking a dynamical question which involves quantum mechanical probabilities. So it can be in eternal creation, whatever.
Right, so it's a fair position to take. I agree. It may be the only possible one.
So the one thing we discussed yesterday was the ADS-CFT example, so that's a complete theory of quantum gravity. We know it's dual to a field theory. We know there are the gap is, there is no single state, period.
Yeah.
And
Okay, but I think you're confusing between the state of the field theory and what this kind of wave function would be.
No, I mean, if we lived in ADS, we would...
Let's live in ADS for a bit. So then the wave function... Yeah, matter and time, asymptotic time, right? That would be the wave function. So clearly, if I'm going to change the configuration here, I'm going to capture a huge number of states in the field theory. In fact, I'm going to deform the field theory that lives here by producing scalar fields.
So, I mean, you have a self-contained system which is a particular CFT.
No. The CFT, the given CFT, does not correspond to a given wave function because the wave function is a function.
The CFT has many states.
Yes.
You could be in any one of them.
Yes.
That's the end of the story.
Exactly. So this wave function does not correspond to a given state in the CFT.
Why not?
Because the wave function is a function of hij and phi at the given time.
But your hij is required to be asymptotically ADS, right? You're only looking at metrics which are with fixed asymptotic boundary conditions.
Sure, but the scalar field can be excited or not or whatever.
Yeah, but you're exciting it by normalizable modes, or standard ADS CFT allows you to change the metric and the matter fields inside.
Yeah,
and those are all.
Sure, but if I excite them, if I put in a black hole with the boundary closures, I'm going to change the state of the CFT, right?
The state of the CFT is whatever.
No, it's not. It can be the vacuum state and it can be a thermal state.
Sure.
Depending on my configuration
here.
That's what we're
saying. Yeah. I'm saying the same.
So there simply is no answer to the question, what is the state?
ADS CFT says the Hilbert spaces are the same, and there's a one-to-one map between states of quantum string theory.
No, Gary. HIJ can change.
Yes.
In one given wave function.
Yes.
Just like X of the harmonic measure.
Yes.
Are we discussing these?
You get a probability for
So in one wave function, I have the vacuum state. If I set HIJ equal to the empty ADS metric. And I have a thermal state if I put in a black hole.
And you can give a given wave function, give different amplitudes to those.
You're just talking about a different basis, but the point is you've got the field theories where the states.
Not all states are semi-classical, so not all states correspond to particular.
Sure, but do you agree that? Okay, but do you agree the vacuum state is different from a thermal state?
Sure.
Do you agree they're both in one wave function?
But I think the only, I think let's back
you
up.
You can take a linear combination of the two if you want to, that's what you're doing. You can take
exactly,
a different basis, it doesn't matter. But the point is, there is a field theory's worth of states. Nothing tells you which state to pick.
Thomas,
all of them are valid.
I think we're agreeing and just talking about different things. So I think your agenda is to just choose a state and find the answer.
Sure.
And we agree you can do that. And then that may in fact be the only
thing. No, but this is different.
Despite
right?
all the angst we have about trying to think
right.
better, it may be the only thing you can do. But we're still thinking about these other questions as
yes.
do from yesterday, which is do we have a way to, or do we get extra guidance? So do we have extra insight into which side a priori we should choose? And I think you've just washed your hands of that question. You're just saying, choose one, choose an H, let's get on with it.
Certainly my approach. Yeah.
So I think there he's decoupled himself.
I've heard Jim Hartle on many occasions at least raise the question of whether quantum gravity will transcend our usual quantum mechanics paradigm in which you pick up an H and you pick a psi. Maybe he said quantum gravity will give us a prescription for a state, or will give us some dynamical.
So we agree it's interesting to wonder about.
He says that it's an interesting question.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah. But I don't think Thomas is doing that now.
No.
Right.
No.
He's just doing a very well posed problem.
I think
it's
what you're
quantum gravity, because this example of ADS CFT is quantum gravity and doesn't.
Well, that was the point, that we have examples now of quantum gravity where you don't see any such.
So it's not looking good.
It's not
looking good. So this idea that quantum gravity will somehow transform our ideas of quantum mechanics and fix
right,
the
but the
now we have some evidence against that.
Okay,
there's
so
another piece that I'm just to repeat very briefly from yesterday, that the stream world sheet is a closed system. It's more analogous to cosmology, and that it doesn't have these asymptotic medias boundary conditions. Theory on closed streams. The analog of picking, you know, the ground state would be to just consider the graviton mode of a string and not any of the excited states, which again, you know, is not the right answer. So, there are others. So that's two.
Okay, but the analog with no boundary and AdS CFT is the Euclidean version of AdS CFT, right? You know, I guess you. So that's a statement that Juan and Gary made. You take Euclidean AdS, you put in some asymptotic boundary, some boundary values, and then the picture there was that at least there's a kind of scaling limit. Okay, so the wave function would then be a function of these boundary values, right? The Euclidean AdS. There's at least a kind of scaling value limit in which this wave function, at least semi-classically, takes the form of what's often called the regularized AdS action, which is a function of these asymptotic quantities, times a bunch of universal surface terms. And then that the statement of AdS CFT comes down to relating that first factor to the partition function of a dual field theory sourced by these asymptotic values. So there you clearly see that a one bulk wave function, does not correspond to a single field theory, but to a whole space of deformations of that field theory, because these sources deform the field theory, right? They turn on, now we're not talking about normalizable modes. Yet they're contained in one bulk wave function. That's your statement, that's the way I understand the boundary wave function. And that's what I was trying to draw in the Lorentzian picture, but let's forget for a moment that Lorentzian view. This is, to me, the connection, at least the level at which I understand it. To me, that's the connection between Hartle-Hawking and AdS CFT. So if you object to this, then I'd be very interested to hear how we're going to restrict to one CFT without any sources, yet reproduce a full wave function, which is a function of asymptotic profiles.
Okay, so what I think Eve and I were saying a moment ago is that in the Lorentzian context, you of course have normalizable excitations and not normalizable
sure.
excitations. Normally, when we talk about states, we're talking about the normalizable modes.
Sure.
So if you restrict to the normalizable modes, then you're fixing your CFT.
Sure.
And then there's a one-to-one correspondence sure. between states. Okay, that's what we were saying.
But I was also saying that this is not a wave function of the universe.
Here you're saying something else. You're looking at the non-normalizable modes and defining your wave function that way, and then you have these two variables.
Right, and you're making an analogy between radial evolution and time evolution here. The state...
No. There's still...
No. I mean, you're talking about a wave function which is a function of H on the boundary of
Euclidean
H. And so it's like he's evolving in time from the middle to...
Yeah. There's no
that,
time.
That is where, you know, I don't see the relevance of this. Directly because continuing from AdS to BS in this way,
you don't need to continue. That's the point.
Either way, if you're making an analogy and saying that you know that something about AdS CFT forces you to something like the no boundary proposal, we have a smooth, you know, starting geometry in your wave function. There are several sort of technical levels on which I don't agree with that.
Yeah.
There can be perfectly well defined resolved.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Singularity
okay, yeah.
to the middle.
Yeah.
There's nothing.
Yeah. So, okay, so now I think.
You to the smooth
So I think this discussion is interesting. You agree with this picture?
Well, I don't agree
formally.
That what you wrote there is a state. You're talking about Euclidean AdS right
it's
now.
The wave function of Euclidean AdS. Sure. As in Euclidean AdS, Euclidean universes. that's what it is for now.
Wait, you want the city's space?
I mean, I didn't write this, right? It's Molos Ina and Horoko.
when you say you include it, you're going to map this to a Lorenzian evolution.
I'm not going to do anything with it for now. I want to focus the discussion on a particular context, which I think is the one which is going to be relevant.
So where is time? That's what I'm asking.
There's no time.
There's no time in the
definition of the state, a la Harlan Walking.
In the Harlan
adopted their proposal.
That's why I say you're going to then evolve it.
Well, okay, but you're right. What we're getting here is a state on a sphere.
Right.
Okay, and there isn't, it's kind of law that they state on a sphere and negative.
That's true. Where is this all going to come from?
It comes from that diversity.
The CFT doesn't talk about it.
So you can choose a state in this way. I understand that you can construct a state in this way.
That's all.
Exactly. Yes.
That's all. And
that's all we were saying.
Okay.
There is a state.
So it's choosing a state.
Analogous to Harlan Walking.
Right. And
you can do this up to the question of continuing the fluxes around. I'm not sure you can really do it that way.
Yeah, no, I don't want to continue for now.
Okay, so
I just want to get
about fluxes.
I want to.
Well, solutions like this stuff.
But is
Yeah.
They have a recent paper where they deal with.
Eva, I want to focus the discussion on a piece of fundamental physics we kind of understand, Euclidean area CFT, where I think the connection between what you do in the CFT and what you aim for ultimately in cosmology is clear. And I agree with you that. Of course, in many examples, many models of Euclidean area CFT, we impose essentially, boundary condition in the center. But sure, there are going to be more general things you can do, allowing specific kind of singularities, which we know how can be resolved in string theory, which potentially modify the field theory. And so then it becomes a very interesting question. What is the state? It's going to be determined by the physics.
By the choice.
Deep in the.
By the choice, you mean. I think that's the intensity of this conversation. Is that is it a choice you're putting in, or is it dictated by the physics?
Okay, so it would come down to a choice of field theory in that context. Yeah. That's right. And it's space of all deformations. That's like. But then I find an appealing picture. And yes, then I do have a story about how this all connects to the boundary wave function without explicit configurations, but allowing for complex sources for certain magnetic fields.
Could you quickly say how what you just described is or is not related to the so-called DSCFT idea? Because people have heard about that. It's those who've read Juan's paper on non-Gaussianity. Might help people understand
right.
more about what you're saying. It sounds a lot like that.
Yes, that's right. So in DSCFT, so now you might think differently. Okay, let's think about the zipper space. Then you would be interested in the wave function for perturbations, for instance.
So again, the idea is there's some Euclidean CFT whose partition function computes the wave function.
Same thing.
Right. At the end of the day, you have to integrate over metrics to compute anything. So then at the end of the day, you still have to integrate over the metrics to be able to compute anything.
But okay, perturbation theory. You can, of course, do it. You can calculate the wave function for fluctuations. And that wave function for fluctuations is nothing but the Harlan Walking wave function in a given background, but expanded around in perturbations, imposing a similar regularity condition.
Which is the assumption you're coming. But you may or may not do that. Right?
That's essentially what they do.
Well, but you don't have to, and that's the whole discussion there.
Sure.
I'm just saying formally what you're talking about over here
right.
has to be...
Exactly. If you would allow certain deviations here from the standard conditions, presumably, that would be analogous to considering different states in cosmology.
But standard conditions, what would you mean?
for hopping.
Yeah.
Okay. You're slipping in the standard correct.
the way we related this, that Euclidean ADS construction to cosmology, was by the observation that, okay, everything in this wave function comes from a saddle point, of course, at the same classical level, and we noticed that these standard Hartle-Hawking saddle points can be replaced by Euclidean ADS saddle points with the same regularity condition. And then with the complex versions of Euclidean ADS saddle points that produce, that calculate the same wave function. And the reason, this is a little technical, right?
Can I ask a very naive question about it? So even the, we know that if you want to do any dynamics in ADS CFT, any real time relational function calculation, we know the Euclidean prescription doesn't work. So why would we expect Euclidean anything to shed any light on this, on real cosmology? I don't understand that logic. I mean, we know that
it's like we're trying to define a tunneling wave function.
It's only an initial state.
But wouldn't you still want to get some dynamics?
Oh yeah, that all is done the usual way.
Okay, so just the initial state.
Yes, the initial state. Only for the start endpoint.
So it's an mathematical school for constructing initial state. Yeah.
And but again, many initial states. So again, like in the think about the string world sheet for those who know. I mean, it's just you can put any vertex up or do you want that at that place where Thomas put regular. You can put anything.
Yeah. Okay, so you would not worry about the Euclidean prescriptions to do any.
But the thing I worry about is sort of talking yourself into a condition that's not really a force.
Nobody uses Euclidean
Nobody then uses Euclidean methods for real time.
Right, just
to figure out where you start with.
Okay. Yeah. So somehow it's going to be going to the standard.
It's basically like the state operator correspondence.
The worry I have with changing too much the singularity condition is that, okay, you can maybe allow for certain singularities, but what are the kind of universes that are going to come out of this?
Well, so think about
the nice thing. The nice thing about the Hartle-Hawking state is that it enforces the fields to have small gradients and small velocities down here, right?
Right.
And that's what goes together with inflation. That is really behind its success.
Wait, so think about the string world sheet for a moment.
No, but think about real universes, maybe.
I mean, this is the most simple case of quantum gravity that we know. And you can insert any operator here, these so-called vertex operators. You can do it in Euclidean calculation, which is in fact the way people tend to do it. And we know there the answer is, you have a full spectrum of consistent physical vertex operators that can be inserted in here.
Yeah.
They are the things which produce all of the string states.
Yeah. I don't
think particles in the usual interpretation of string theory.
Yeah.
That's just again.
Yeah.
No.
I don't deny that. I was asking a question from an observational viewpoint. There's a whole ensemble of universes that come with a given condition here because the wave function is a function of the boundary matrix. And then there's a question in this model, what are those universes? Do they inflate or don't they? And I don't think it's that easy to construct quantum states in this of the universe predict inflation.
But Thomas, that's the kind of thing, that's the issue, because that to say that, and it might be true, seems to be abandoning one of the early goals of inflation, which is to say all kinds of states can inflate, and that's what's wonderful about inflation. So if you buy into that early vision, that's you're asking statements like what you just made are saying you're letting go of that, which may be what we have to do. So I'm not, but it's just noting. So I think what I can do here is just note that you seem to be giving up on that, and for the reasons, and it's exactly that question of, how much do you have to coddle inflation to get it started? Do you have to give it very special states? Do you have to make very special choices, or is it something very broad that can give inflation? And that's,
Okay, so that's a very interesting question.
And I think it's a very, you know, when you sort of scan the realities, it seems like we may just have to give up on that. So, but that's interesting in itself, because it's a view that's influenced the field over the last few decades.
Right. Has gotten in trouble with this.
Right.
It was controversial from the start.
Right. Well, Penrose picked up on basically these issues.
And any finite amount of inflation doesn't really solve the problem, because you can always evolve back and find some initial
So people start picking away at this issue from the start.
It changes. It just takes small things into big things, but they're small structural on smaller scales.
But I think it's good for us to face that we're headed down this path and assess it, and it's interesting.
But again, there's a tone, which I know you appreciate, but there's a perfectly valid point of view where you treat phenomenological inflation as any other model of physics that are different from, you know, tabletop condensed matter or whatever else.
And, exactly. So we're lucky. So we should count ourselves lucky. We were so inspired by Alan's paper that we got models that actually worked, and then had this great phenomenology, even as the original vision was, well, perhaps just flawed, or at least not yet realized if we're more optimistic.
But I don't think it's that bad either, right? So imagine Eva comes up with a way to modify this regularity condition in a controlled way, and yet preserve inflationary dynamics.
Sure, it's not, I mean, what do you mean preserve inflationary dynamics?
I mean that you get inflationary universes out of it.
How about like one particle over
at least for small?
Just excite one particle over the Hurl argument. Is that not going to inflation?
Okay, but here at the bottom.
Right, at the bottom.
Yeah, okay, you have to have a controlled way to modify backgrounds, of course, right? I'm not talking about the wave function in a fixed background.
Okay.
Okay? I'm talking about an ensemble of cosmological backgrounds here.
No, okay, because you're just saying, you know, take the wave function you think is the one that prefers inflation, and then modify it in some small way. That's more or less the spirit of this question.
I understand, but
how are you
fixing the background and modify it's no help here. I'm asking.
What's the background?
Well, we have an inflationary background here, and we have another one there. And these inflationary backgrounds are selected by the wave function, and there are many other backgrounds for which phi dot is much larger than the slow roll condition, and that don't inflate. What is the space of wave functions that selects inflation? I think that's a question that
for example. But
it's a good thing, because those wave functions, once you select those, will probably lead to more specific predictions than claiming total ignorance about the state, which leads to this paradox.
So this seems right also, that there are quote unquote measures that are so that make, I guess, stream predictions are actually wrong.
Yeah.
But I think you can also I don't know. It's fine, it's interesting, but it's also I would ask at some point, as why have you selected wave functions that lead to inflation? What about wave functions that just give a big bang without inflation? And how do you, how do you navigate that stuff? And
very good question.
And the old school thinking is inflation is somehow drawing you toward it by its universality, by its attractor nature and all of that. And the agenda you're proposing here is not really engaging that. At least naively, it doesn't engage engaging
level
that.
The next level of engaging is, okay, what is the space of wave functions? And you could study it from a theoretical and observational point of view. No, it's just that. It's like the space, like the structure of the landscape. Sure,
it seems what you're doing is letting go of some of the baggage of inflation, some of the old school baggage of inflation, just kind of stepping,
yeah, maybe
building up the picture and
maybe from saying,
well, look, the technology's been great, so let's embrace it as a, we suspect it is part of our past history, so let's embrace that piece and kind of see where it leads us.
Right, but I started off by asking a very simple observational question, which is not answered by the old school of physics. Right? That's my motivation.
The old school of inflation.
Old school.
So this is like more old school physics, where you're worried about initial, where what you're describing is like the way every physicist has always worked with initial conditions for all of time, except for cosmologists trying to do inflation.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So it's very honorable and
except for,
yeah, it's very tradition in physics. And then maybe much more sensible than what we were trying to do. But it's just it's an interesting to note.
But also, why are you assuming that whatever comes before, whoever is making these choices already is wave functional? You know, why can't be something in between? And there's, yeah, I don't know. You could imagine some sort of other dynamical system before that is populating this and it's acting in some way, and then the next step is like some wave function.
Oh, okay, sure, you can do that, but
yeah,
interesting.
How do you know? I'm asking.
Of course, we don't know, but the interesting thing is that the notion in the case.
So what you can do is, if I find this wave function, I don't make ridiculous predictions. You will accomplish this.
No, but there's more, right? These, in these saddle points, under the boundary saddle points, you can identify at what point a classical cosmological background evolution emerges as a prediction of the wave function. And you find that those backgrounds emerge in an inflationary state. So within the limited context of Harold Hawking and his landscape, you find that there's no space in between. You find that classicality, classical cosmological evolution emerges in an inflationary state. But there could be other theories where this is different. Sure, but this is consistent in the way we've been.
So in practical terms, is what you're saying that you find that the potential always dominates, for example, the kinetic time.
Right.
Exactly.
In a regime where that's my point.
That's what's special.
That's why I asked the question to Eva. If you modify it significantly, different backgrounds, I think you'd be hard pressed to find inflation. And then the question becomes, what's the space of wave functions that is compatible with?
So then I agree, you can regard it as evidence in some sense for the combination of size and ages that produce what we observe, and to the extent that that allows you to disentangle things, that's
right.
Great, but it may not.
Or maybe even if you're lucky, produce some additional signature you can look forward.
Yeah, right. Then if you're, yeah, exactly. So that was the motivation for my paper, right? There was a little bit of an additional signature. The Harold Hawking zooms down on these bubble potentials, and therefore.
So did I hear you say you're predicting no B-modes?
Right.
Yes, your prediction?
Yes.
Because?
So how, yeah, lucky.
Don't forget, you should explain a bit.
In the context of a simple polynomial landscape, which has a range of plateau potentials and a range of polynomial potentials, without a strong statistical bias for one or the other, the boundary wave function predicts that a classical cosmological background, R patch, emerges in an inflationary state from a plateau which has a relatively low value of potential. Okay, that's all I'm saying in this specific context.
There are both options, and you use
the
sense that you don't have saddle points in the other solutions.
We do. No, we do.
They are lower probability.
That's right. That's right. Okay. Yeah. Sure. We don't have one background, right? We have universes here, universes there. It's a multiverse, like an ensemble of universes, and each comes with a probability from that saddle point. And then you look at what the probability is.
So I gather Paul Steinhardt doesn't like this wave function.
What is the formula, like, in terms of R?
No, that's right, but he implicitly uses probably a different way.
Exactly. So it's kind of an illustration.
So what is your, if you want to write a formula, it's e to the minus and R how or 0.01, yeah, what is the number? What is your formula? If you have some, let me give you just some, m squared phi square, and then it saturates, because
the two cases are totally flat.
Yeah, m squared phi square, and then it has to saturate.
Yeah.
It has to saturate, and it saturates at different values.
Yeah, phi to the p.
Which one? Which p? P to the minus.
P equals 3 halves. No, 2/3, sorry.
When is the one true answer?
The lowest p, okay? The lowest p is exponentially favored.
But how much?
Exponentially. I mean, it's, okay, what enters, what's the key ingredient here? It's the threshold for eternal inflation. It's a critical value on different sides. The potential value at the threshold of eternal inflation in different directions in this landscape sets the probability.
But for example, I would think that this monoadic, I mean, they don't have any eternal inflation.
They don't.
Because before you get there, the whole thing breaks up. So there's no
because you lose your approximation.
You put in the normalization of the power spectrum. So you put in that phenomenology, and then as Matthias says, you go out for a long field range, but not.
Prediction. You gave me the landscape, right? Excuse me. You have to give me the landscape, and then I'm making a prediction in our
model. We're giving you this landscape, though. We're trying to make it.
If you have a landscape without any regime of eternal inflation,
yes,
the Hartle-Hopkins wave function is ruled out. That's clear.
But that would
go against conventional wisdom.
If we scale over
it's conventional.
If we scale
then the eternal inflation is generic.
Yeah, but then this means that the potential, the phi to the p part of the potential that is setting the predictions has nothing to do with the part that has to do with the eternal inflation. So how are you going to, these two things don't come together in this landscape?
I mean, we could let it flow.
Okay,
let the amplitude flow. So you
go way down, and then you can
internally inflate.
That's
what this prefers, is that correct? So in that sense, it would prefer not,
and
prefer
the
wrong density
perturbations.
You phrased it that way.
Yeah, I conditioned in this paper on Q,
right?
On observable range.
Okay, then that is what Matthias said. I mean, it's...
Yeah, it's the no boundary wave function selects regions of eternal inflation, wherever they may be in the landscape.
Can you say anything about the number of
E-foldings? Well, once you select it, it selects backgrounds emerging at the higher potential. So what I assumed here was, of course...
I think that was a different question. The E-foldings affecting our universe, that's what you mean.
Yeah.
E-foldings out of the
point. Okay.
It looks like what you're saying is that you're favoring low values of the cosmological constant, so maybe
the vacuum energy.
Yeah, vacuum energy. So.
I think what you were thinking about, what I assumed here, very simple toy model for H, was of course no additional parameters in between the observable range and much higher up the eternal inflation pressure. If you give me a more complicated landscape, where some of these directions have no regime of eternal inflation, or there are corrections that sort of make it flatter sooner, additional terms. But of course, on purpose, I didn't include extra additional terms, because any additional terms would correspond to additional structure on the landscape, which is probably going to be there, but okay, the point of this paper was to not assume structure of the landscape and purely see the effect of the nature condition. And I don't think there's going to be no eternal inflation at all in the stream landscape.
The models that we know that produce large gravitational waves do not have in the regime which is connected to this eternal inflation.
Within themselves.
So they're probably living some landscape with a solution that is patched to it in a way we don't know how to connect.
For instance, I had that discussion with Liam on his statistics of deep brain inflation, right? Where we immediately found a subset of the potentials that he realizes have these inflection points at sufficiently flat potential, right, so that he has this inflection point potential, where the conditions for eternalization hold. Then, of course, those guys are not, the regime for that covers our observations is not directly related to that batch, it is related much further. So there you already have a set of examples where So that's a complete toy model. You write down that potential, you realize.
Yeah, but those examples don't have gravity waves to start with. So
So I'm not making any. The claim about gravity waves is in the context of the landscape that I wrote down in my paper. This provides a different toy model context where you can be as explicit as I was there. And what is the effect of the no boundary condition, for instance? It selects, so if you remember Liam's story, he had realizations of potentials where he had a blue tilt and a red tilt or in between. The no boundary story, the no boundary wave function applied to that ensemble selects the models where in the observable range the tilt is red, because the inflection point is the first condition of eternalization beyond those observations. So that's a kind of very sort of down to earth phenomenology with the wave function of the universe, right? That's what it is.
So the principle is that there needs to be some ethanol inflation somewhere.
In this particular wave function for it to be with observations, yes.
And by which you don't consider false vacuum eternal inflation as being relevant. Why is that?
So let's add a direction where the potential is of the false vacuum type.
Yeah.
Then the condition for eternal inflation is satisfied here, so yes. It also contributes.
Yes, good.
Right, but the point is that, at least in the general law, but I think this is very difficult to verify, this value of the false vacuum is typically much higher than the value of the observable range of field values. The potential is much lower here. Whereas in these plateau potentials, without adding further parameters, the threshold of eternal inflation is not much higher than this range. It can be, it's a bit higher, but not much. And so the reason is, okay, these false vacuum potentials contribute, but they don't dominate in the no-boundary state because these guys have been
lower. Actually, I think you should look at this unwinding inflation because people basically create more or less no enlarged field models from a tunneling event, which is relatively close to the phenomenological regime of those models. So
I think that might be
a place where your thing would apply, and then you might produce gravity natural.
Yes. So again, additional structure like what you mentioned can easily modify those.
In your scheme, are you using volume as a weighting in some way?
The volume weighting enters in those predictions to the extent that it selects the different regimes of eternal inflation.
That's a measure choice.
But for example, for you, imagine that you merge up there, and now I change the 16 foldings. And the further down, I make the potential flatter or lower or something, so that I make more volume in one. But it's not connected to the top.
Eternal inflation.
But I create some, 10 more e-folds.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you say anything about them? No, they are equal.
No. No. Yeah. Okay. The volume weighting is a whole different story.
Is the volume coming in as changing the probability in the wave function, or is it something you're putting in?
It's in the wave function. It's in
so the more volume is causing the wave function to assign larger probability to that.
Well, the wave function produces.
So just to warn you, so I've been thinking a lot about these measures, and I've concluded that just explicitly weighting by volume is wrong. And that the reasoning, if you're reasoning, well, there's going to be more observers there or something, well, that's actually wrong. So I'm taking that position, which maybe not everyone here agrees with.
I agree with that position.
Okay. But somehow it's affecting.
It's a
more concrete way than that.
Right.
Okay.
The wave function provides probabilities for all kinds of observables, and the ones that are relevant for observations select those thresholds for the communication. Nothing to do with the counting.
So you've been going for an hour and
longer than I expected.
Well, thank you. I think it was really good discussion. So we want to Chell in sometime.
I don't know, it doesn't have to be this week, and this is an interesting discussion.
So a naive question, to what extent can I still, to what extent can I still teach my students that inflation solves the horizon and plans?
You can say that it's 100%. You can still say we start with, you know, a control factor of 10 between your initial curvature and your patch level, your initial gradients and your patch level, your density of monocles and your patch level. Inflation will remove all of it. And
right.
So that's just true.
But if what I'm hearing, you know, it's more likely to create a big bang, right? Inflation is a big bang from initial state.
So
is that not true? Or not universally agreed upon.
The letter is for sure.
So since you provoked me with this 10, this sort of within a factor of 10, that's not. So as far as I can tell, the question of general initial conditions starting inflation is just totally unsupported. That dream we had 30 years ago, that you sort of inflation was this thing that could take any old crap you give it and create the universe we observe, it's just failed. And the horizon and flatness problem are kind of the stand-ins for that in the classic discussion. Now, then in the face of that, you can say, oh yeah, but if you make, you know, very simple, suppose you have basically FRW with a little more curvature and not too much of this or that, you can still get inflation, that's great, there's a technical result, but it doesn't come close to addressing the grander, the big question of is inflation really working the way we thought it would? So that's where, and so the reason I get pushed back when people talk about these little models, well, what if there's a little more curvature, a little more gradient, is that just is so far removed from these grand claims.
It's not a little more, it's a factor of e to the 60 more. I mean, it's
But compared to all the initial states that Thomas was just running away from, because he says, oh, they're not gonna get inflation, so we gotta exclude them somehow. It's nowhere near addressing the fact that you've eliminated this huge piece of, you know, all these vertex.
But it's still true that if inflation starts, then you see no curvature.
I mean,
right.
But if inflation starts, then you see no model. But even in this sense, inflation explains why we don't see all of these things.
As long as you haven't assumed too much curvature.
Yeah, that's the factor of 10.
If inflation starts,
As long as you haven't assumed curvature.
But if inflation starts as this huge condition.
No.
If inflation starts, maybe you want to call it a huge condition. But if inflation starts, all of the things are continue to be true as they always have, up to some factor. You know, if you only have 60, then you see something. But if you have 70, you see nothing. Okay, that's
right. So that's fine. That's fine. But that's.
This might even be practical. Like, suppose this anomaly got more significant, and then it had the interpretation of some relic gradient at the beginning, that all of it didn't go away.
Yeah.
So would you consider that evidence for inflation doing this job of, you know,
I just think that's a non. It would be so exciting. I wouldn't be having these arguments about is inflation doing its job exactly. Not we'd be focusing on the mechanism and the physics that might do that.
It's another field. It's not revolutionary. It just maybe gives more evidence.
Yeah, something much more concrete. That would be something much more concrete to talk about.
I don't understand how you can say that it's not explaining one of the an explanation is all. If the happens, then these things go away.
So,
but there's always if the explaining thing happens. If the explaining thing doesn't happen, then the things go away. That's the definition of an explanation. I don't understand.
Because the original.
What's the original thing? The explanation has to start always.
Yes.
No, I mean, come on.
Yes. Come on.
This was the claim. Is a silly claim.
But it is a silly claim. I mean, I don't. I mean, it's fine. I mean,
is like...
In what sense? Because, I mean, you can always say, I started in the W hot universe.
Exactly. Of course, that's what, it was the ridiculous naive thing that everyone was doing.
I would read it because I doubt you can even say this. I mean, it's always if the... How can we say the inflation has to have started?
So so what does it mean to explain fine-tuning? What does it mean to explain fine-tuning? That's the language Alan uses in this paper. So the fine-tuned conditions of the universe are explained. If you put fine-tuning in to begin with, that's not explaining fine-tuning. It might explain things.
So the factor of 10 is not a fine-tune,
is it?
It always doesn't have to quite be 10.
But I think that's just so small in the grand scheme of things. I mean, here Thomas is throwing out almost all possible wave functions, and then you want to say
I'm not sure there's a wave function for everything.
Okay. So now we're saying, but you're still throwing out this huge.
That's right. Just because there's an infinite number of things doesn't mean there's all possibilities. You know, the string landscape is a good example.
But also, yeah.
There's a lot of solutions, but almost nothing.
Okay, so all possible.
But it's the same with your deformations, right? They're going to be governed by certain rules when you relax the regularity condition in the interior.
Yeah, for sure.
And so there are some constraints.
So it would be wonderful if when you study that, you find something much more concrete and find that inflation is more generic. And I'm actually with you. I have not completely given up on this.
It has nothing to do with the inflation explaining the observations.
Right.
It's like any other process. You say, it's raining. It's raining, okay? Yeah. Then you don't have to.
It's
raining, the water is coming down.
It depends on what the meaning of inflation is, okay?
Yeah.
That's all we're...
It's
metaphysics.
I don't
know
what kind of
argument.
It's like
saying, you know, in college, see, if you want to explain these branching ratios, you use the standard model, even though the standard model does not in itself explain where the LHC came from.
Yeah, exactly. So
you need to explain
it. Fine, it explains. But Matthias, the original baggage that came with inflation, that's not what explaining means, or that's not what the agenda is. I don't care what words you use. We're physicists. We don't care what words we use, right? But the idea was you're making the broadest assumptions about initial states. And you get the universe like we observe. And it's so entertaining to see all these young people just shaking their heads saying, how could anyone believe that?
So I see it as a much more mechanical process than what you just described. So I just kind of trace it backwards. This could lead to what we see today.
Yes, that's it. That's the only way inflation has succeeded.
That's
just a fact. It's just a fact. And people who hope for it to be otherwise are busy counting pocket universes and getting confused about the infinities. I agree. That's the only thing we have to work with right now if we want to talk about inflation. And it's a great thing. We shouldn't be sad about that.
Alan gave some probability. I should read this
book. Yeah, go read it.
Some probability of saying inflation will always happen, this kind of thing.
Well, the expectation was that you would, that it was a generic thing that would happen.
Oh yeah, but that's been amplified upon by many others. Andy's right, that was the prevailing view.
By the way, there's perturbations. but this was
that's okay. I mean, things are not always discovered in the most logical way.
I'm not saying it's wrong. I just want to be clear about where we've come.
There is the unheard voice in the room, which I hate to represent, but I mean, you could argue that, for example, the problem with the cyclic scenario is a problem of getting adequate initial conditions if you want to propagate the perturbations through the bounds, whatever that means, right? So there are other theories that suffer from initial condition problems. That would be one way to state their problems. Yeah, but I guess that's what I'm saying. Inflation is not unlike its competitors. Maybe they just have
I'm certainly not using it to promote the cyclic one.
I think it's really funny
actually to identify these problems and then that means I should
believe the second one, which as far as I know has all exactly.
That's definitely exactly. What I'm saying. I'm just saying that if you want to argue against inflation, you could argue that it suffers from the same issue.
But I'm not arguing against inflation. I'm just agreeing, I think, with the sense in this room that where inflation has succeeded is as a mechanism. And if you want to use the word explain, you can use the word explain, because indeed it's a crank that we think turned in the early universe that generated all this cool stuff that we observe. And that's pretty amazing. I don't, for a minute, discount what an amazing thing that is for us to have. But it is, thank you, Thomas, for remembering. I mean, there's this baggage, and it's carried mainly by older people who were around when Julesworth's early paper. But that there was this whole other agenda, and it just hasn't been realized, and it could well not be realizable at all in any physical form. But we can develop. But some of us remain a little bit inspired that maybe there's some way. But
I think it's actually hurting this field a little bit. So I'm kind of an outsider. But then you heard these partial stories about people objecting to inflation because of these kind of
point. Yeah, I agree. Because I agree. It's totally. It should be separated. It should be separated.
Right,
so and it's a big mistake that right. people drag in, people blame inflation for failing to do this grand thing, when in fact it's doing just fine as a phenomenology, as a machinery in the early
for example. Yeah, but what you say also implies that it's incomplete, right? In a very profound way.
Yeah, but
for instance, that question that I started out with.
But at the very shallow
level, it's okay for.
Right, but
for,
I think, but accept that the initial conditions, we're normally happy for them to be chosen rather.
Right, exactly. Like in this ADS CFT example, I wouldn't call it incomplete. It's just the complete framework is known, and too bad the answer is there isn't a preferred state. That's all there is to it.
It's good solid physics.
Fine.
Good solid physics.
So that might be the correct answer. Yeah. We don't know.
And how do we, I mean, doesn't this kill the whole product? Because how do we know that, why don't we live in ADS? And if we were to live in ADS, is that a possibility? And there we know there is no preferred state. So in the scheme of all possibilities where we would live, then there is no preferred state. End of story.
Right, the theory can't predict. I mean,
the theory cannot predict because ADS is just fine.
We happen to know that we don't from the operation,
but we don't. From the theory, we don't. Like in the, there was a choice and we ended up here, but this choice
and that's so normal in physics to separate. It's why, you know, when people analyze particle results, they don't wonder why is there an LHC. I mean, after a few beers they do debate about, you know, what accelerator was built and what wasn't, but it's not considered a physics problem. Right. So
okay, so on that note, maybe we can.
Thank you.
Thank you.